This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 5th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today on my last ever in the Section D hot seat, I indulge in meeting one of my favourites, the Brazilian architect Issy Weinfeld, to talk quality of life.
I could never live in a place that I design because I'm not designing for myself. It's for another family. It has to do with them.
Plus, we dip into the archive to hear a couple of my personal highlights from the last 100 or so shows. And when we made spoons in the rain at last year's New York Design Week.
So much design goes into a really nice spoon that it's deceptively simple when you see it.
All that and much more besides coming up today on Section D on Monocle 24. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, for my last ever show, it was with great privilege that I had an audience with Brazilian architect Issy Weinfeld. As a leader of the tropical modernism movement, Weinfeld has worked extensively in his home nation and abroad, across all sectors, including residential, commercial, and hospitality. During the recent Monocle Quality of Life conference in Lisbon, I stepped out with Issy to discuss how to build the perfect home and how architecture helps shape the lives of those that experience it.
I feel 95% of the places, I think people just copy what they saw in a magazine. And then you see places designed by interior designers or architects that is beautiful, photographed in a magazine, but has no life. And this is not a home. Then the role of an architect, of an interior designer, first, this affinity with the client is so important because if you take a job that you know that the client will go forward, they will take your project forward, a step in many steps, every day changing. Because what I hate is you see a house and finished by a professional that you feel it's the look of the professional. This is why I'm always saying that I could never live in a place that I design because I'm not designing for myself. Yeah. It's for another family. It has to do with them. It's difficult to find people also that can, that like to buy, like the mess. This is home. This is not a house to win an award and to be featured in a magazine. This is fake. And I really don't appreciate works that I can see the hand of the architect.
But there is a sort of, I guess, a slight contradiction there in the fact that, to me, my idea of a perfect home would probably be a home designed by you. You have a kind of a very sort of identifiable style that I think a lot of clients must come to you because they want that look that's very much your signature. How do you sort of work with that when you design a home for someone that's the very looks like it's come from your drawing board, but then you encourage them to decorate as they please or add their things? Do a lot of your clients want that, or do they just want to buy a house by you?
No, if they want to buy, I can feel, and I don't take this project anymore for many years because I know that when they give me, you have total freedom to do it. We just want exactly what you do. This is not something interesting for me.
And I mean, a lot of your work is obviously in Brazil, in your homeland, and obviously designing homes in Brazil come with it certain pressures. And I'm thinking sort of the security measures in particular. I mean, you mentioned today about, the huge sort of security walls that you have to build and little guardhouses and stuff. What are the other kind of any special pressures or things that designing a house in Brazil entails?
As we have this problem, we still have, but we are trying to remove these fences in our projects and these big walls. Unfortunately, because I like the relation between the private home and the street, But as you cannot see the house from outside, I try to turn the house to the site and to have maximum relation with the garden that they can. At least to have something that they have some privacy, because unfortunately they need. And then most of the time I turn the house with the back to the street. That this is not a good solution, but it's depending on where are you building. And in São Paulo, most of the time, till now, we design like this because we need to. But it's part of the work. Like you have the rules from the city, like you have the budget, like you have the sun, where is the sun, and like you have the program of the house, then you have this security, and the final work is the result of everything together. Trying to answer again your last question that I forgot to mention, that I hate to repeat myself. Then if a client comes with asking to repeat, because this is again something that I have no motivation, because I like so many things, to find a style for me or to print, you know, a label. It's the beginning of a decadence of an artist, or to have a formula. And then when you finally find a formula and you want to repeat yourself because it's easy for you, you can have money and do the same thing. This is exactly what I hate.
That was me talking to Brazilian architect Essie Weinfeld in Lisbon recently during Monocle's inaugural Quality of Life conference. As this is my last time presenting the show, I thought it might be a good opportunity to look back at a couple of my favourite Section D moments. Let's go back to this time last year in New York, to the garden of the Standard Hotel in the East Village. The wind and the rain that we braved there was rather appropriate, given the provenance of the company who was showing there. Makers and Brothers is an online venture set up by brothers Jonathan and Mark Legg, dedicated to showcasing, selling and supporting the best of Irish craft, and some more besides. In New York, they made a mock-up of the tin shed they work from at their base close to Dublin, where they presented a range of pieces, including ceramics by Derek Wilson, glassware by Gerpoint, and woodwork by James Carroll. James was also on site braving the elements with us, whittling a set of wooden spoons in a makeshift workshop space.
This is a walnut from upstate New York we got, and I'm working it green, which means it's not been seasoned, so it's much easier to split and carve and shape because it's got moisture in it. So what I'm using is a fro to split it with. It's a bit like a long thin axe, and a maul to hit the fro with to split the wood. I'm going to split it now. American walnut, so I've only used Irish walnut before, and it's similar, but it's a bit more stringy. Yeah, it's a nice smell off it, and it looks lovely. It's a simple basic knife that you use, and a hook knife and an axe, so they're very simple tools, but they could take a whole lifetime to try and master, but you learn a lot all the time as you do it, and it's quite nice because it's almost the ideal object. You're constantly turning it around in your hand, and you're considering all the, you're seeing a 3D image all the time as you rotate it, so you're making design decisions all the time. And there's so much design goes into a really nice spoon that it's deceptively simple when you see it. So it's a bit of an unusual thing to do in downtown Manhattan, using an axe and stuff, you know, in a constructive way. It's nice engaging with people passing, you know, that's great.
So how long have you been doing this for?
I've been working with wood for about 20 odd years. I've just been getting into carving spoons over the last year or so.
Yeah.
And it's probably certainly another 50 years of learning anyway, and there's lots of growing interest in it because it's something people can do for themselves, and something we use every day as a spoon, so why not be a wooden spoon you made yourself?
Yeah.
The walnut smells nice, all right. I use finish it with a knife, so I wouldn't use sandpaper to finish it, but it gives a nice hard finish and makes it kind of user-friendly. It doesn't absorb the cooking stuff. This is a hook knife used for taking out the bowl of the spoon.
So how's the reaction been with people on the street, sort of walking past and seeing?
A lot of them have been confused, but it's nice when people make the effort to engage with it a bit, and yeah. People really do. They might still be confused at the end, but at least they've hopefully learned something. People respond really well to it. It's a real basic kind of a thing that they can see what's happening right in front of them, and everyone relates to a spoon, I suppose.
Why did you choose the wooden spoon to sort of show off your skills and to bring here? What was it about?
It's just sort of a perfectly contained thing to do. It's obviously mobile and simple. It's also, as being simple, it's quite it's difficult. Yeah. And people can relate to it. That's probably the best thing.
As James continued to work his wood, I took shelter with Makers & Brothers creative director, Jonathan Legg, about setting up shop in New York.
Makers & Brothers is an online venture I started with my brother 2.5 years ago. And I guess it was kind of a reaction to the way we felt Irish design was being represented, and we wanted to find another way to do it and make it more relevant to a global audience. And that's why we set it up. And we also believe that there was a lot of interesting work out there with raw, genuine qualities to bring value to everyday life and, yeah, enhance people's surroundings. If your home is full of products that have those qualities, like where you understand the provenance, you appreciate how it's been made, they have that tactility that brings a warmth to the environment, then yeah, they're the type of products we wanted to show people and share with people.
And why bring it to New York? Why is it a great showcase for you to be involved in?
We have a load of customers over here.
Is the Irish connection or...?
No, I don't think it is, no, because most of them actually don't have that Irish thing going on, though a lot of Americans do. Even, yeah, earlier today, there was quite a few of those in. I guess they've read about us and heard about it and they've bought off us, but the nature of what we sell, you can't pick up on it at all in a picture. Like, you need to hold it and touch it and smell it and feel it.
Yeah.
So we kind of have a commitment to doing 3 or 4 pop-ups a year. I guess we enjoy the theatre of it as much as anything else.
It is a nice spectacle here, isn't it?
It's quite fun building a shed in a garden in the middle of Manhattan and having James here with his axe. Yeah, there's a nice story to that.
A bit more about some of your favourite things or some of the new items you've got here.
New items? We've got really beautiful ties and bow ties that are woven on a little island off the west coast of Ireland called Inishman. We love them because they use very traditional weaves. They have an amazing archive built up, predominantly actually from the owners of the company just observing the local fishermen and asking them about their jumpers and saying, oh, where did that stitch come about? Which is quite interesting. And we're going to do some jumpers with them in October coming in. And our jumpers are going to have special sleeves because traditionally when wives were knitting jumpers for their husbands, they would put a special pattern on just one of the sleeves, like a lucky stripe, like in the same, I guess, the way maidens and knights gave each other silk ties. So the fishermen's wives would have put, like, just the pattern on the sleeve would have just gone a little weird at one point. So, yeah, all our jumpers are going to have lucky sleeves, which we're quite excited by.
And as the rain began to clear with all the luck of the Irish, James Carroll's wooden spoon finally took shape.
I've let this dry just over quite a short time because it's quite thin, it dries out quickly. Then I can finish it with a knife and it will give a better finish once it's dried out a bit. And I use the knife to finish it because it actually slices through the cells better. I don't ever sand the spoons. So it gives a much nicer finish. It feels nicer and it wears much better. And you can finish it in a couple of different things. You can use linseed oil or walnut oil or different oils that are going to stop it from absorbing too much of the cooking juices and stuff like that. And it'll change colour a little bit from depending on what you use it for, and we'll give it some more additional patina. That's kind of quite a nice thing, I think, rather than...
What's about the character of the technique that you've used that sort of creates all these sort of lumps and bumps and real sort of personality to it?
I think it gives it... It obviously looks more handmade when you see the tool marks in the finished product, so I like that. And each one is obviously individual as well. It's not quite symmetrical, and you can see the different knife cuts being made in it. Makes it a more tactile object to use. It's a tool, really. It's a tool for cooking and eating.
That was James Carroll talking to me there, along with Makers & Brothers creative director Jonathan Legg at their pop-up shop at the Standard Hotel in the East Village during New York Design Week last year. And you can read a bit more about the Makers & Brothers project in the recent April issue of Monocle.
Monocle Films explores the art of a warm welcome with Fabrica's design team to celebrate a special collaboration with Airbnb at the Palazzo Crespi in Milan.
Traveling is like life, and it's about the way we put things together, and slowly, slowly, if you cook it well, it can become something. And then you rearrange it, you design it.
Housewarming, design ingredients for a welcoming experience. Now playing in the film section of Monocle.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Let's dip a bit closer into the archives now and head to London's V&A Museum and its retrospective of the work of Alexander McQueen, entitled Savage Beauty. When the show opened, and it runs through the rest of this summer, I met with the V&A's Kate Bethune to talk us through the life and the legacy of one of fashion's greats. So let's start with, Alexander McQueen, not living, but certainly a living memory. And this is kind of the biggest fashion exhibition of its kind ever to be held at the V&A. Why do you think McQueen warranted such a huge retrospective show?
There aren't many designers who can warrant their own show that fills three galleries at the V&A, and it is the V&A's largest fashion exhibition. But McQueen was the most influential designer of his generation, and for many different reasons. He provoked with new silhouettes like his bums to trousers, with the waistband that was cut 5 centimetres below that of hipsters to elongate the torso and expose the lower spine. He astonished with the extraordinary range of materials he used. He didn't just render his designs in fabric, he used balsa wood, raffia, glass microscope slides, and he absolutely astounded people with his compelling and spectacular catwalk shows that often involved avant-garde installation. They were provocative and they were extremely powerful.
And what sort of pressure, because he was such a showman and there's always that element of the performance, has that put an immense pressure on you to sort of recreate that here, to do storytelling like he did, and to really kind of summon up that element of the circus that he always had at his shows?
McQueen was a masterful storyteller, and his collections always involved elaborate narratives. And as I said, the shows were absolutely spectacular. We've worked really hard to try and bring a sense of the drama and the spectacle that was synonymous with his shows. We have a soundscape that's been curated for each of the galleries to bring a sense of that drama. We have a cabinet of curiosities that's been doubled in height and doubled the amount of objects. It includes 27 screen showing many of McQueen's catwalk shows, and we have the most incredible restaging of the Pepper's Ghost, which was the finale to one of McQueen's most memorable catwalk shows, The Widows of Culloden, and it was when Kate Moss appeared as an ethereal apparition on a glass pyramid at the centre of the catwalk. It's one of the most beautiful moments, and I think visitors will leave with that in their memories.
Here we are sitting at the press preview, of which I've been to many, and I'm sure you have too. The atmosphere here is quite stirring. People are quite emotional, aren't they? I've seen a couple of you with tears in their eyes. There's something about McQueen that really sort of summoned up emotions in people.
People are very emotional today. When you see the breadth of his creative output on display here, so we have garments and accessories on display right from his Jack the Ripper Stalks His Victims collection, his graduate collection of 1992, right through to his final collection that was finished by Sarah Burton after his death. It's very poignant, it's very moving, it's very powerful, and especially when people walk into that cabinet and get that sense of an overwhelming number of objects. It's the most intriguing space, and it's one of my favourite spaces because it draws on all of McQueen's many rich and diverse collaborations. Although he was remarkably talented himself, he recognised talent in others, and these objects pay tribute to those rich and diverse collaborations.
But also, the show hasn't been arranged chronologically, it's thematically. How did you go about sort of choosing what would go into each section? And can you talk us through some of the sections? We're in Romantic Gothic at the moment. How did you go about sort of organising his portfolio?
We were really fortunate to inherit a brilliant curation from Andrew Bolton, our ex-V&A colleague. We have also been fortunate in that we've been able to add to the curation with 66 additional garments and accessories. And even with the luxury of more space, it's been very, very difficult because his body of work was just incredible. But the exhibition has been arranged thematically to draw on the key aspects that resurface in his collections. For example, his engagement with the Gothic tradition, which was a very romantic Gothic. Sometimes he drew on aspects such is the melancholy associated with the Victorian period, rendering a garment, a corset that has a ground of lilac, which is the colour of half mourning. But one of his most consistent references was nature and the natural world. He was a bird watcher, a scuba diver, and Romantic Naturalism is an incredible gallery that pays tribute to his fascination for the natural world.
We should talk also about this idea of legacy. I mean, can you imagine, is there any other living designer at the moment that had sort of the guts that McQueen did? Do you think was he the sort of the last of that generation of real sort of pioneering thinkers in the mainstream fashion industry?
I think McQueen's greatest legacy was cementing London as a global fashion city. I mean, he followed in the vein of designers such as Vivienne Westwood and John Galliano, but his fearless and radical visions really did change the face of fashion, and they made his work relevant to an audience beyond the fashion industry. He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion, and he continues to inspire a new generation of designers and creatives.
Kate Bethune, senior researcher of the Alexander McQueen Savage Beauty exhibition, talking to me at the V&A Museum here in London. And that show runs until August the 2nd. Now, it's only appropriate that my last episode of Section D coincides with the recent design-dedicated May issue of Monocle. At the very back, you'll find a well-appointed dispatch from our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous, about one of the Spanish capital's most iconic apartment blocks. The Edificio Princesa was built in the twilight years of the Franco dictatorship as a homestead for the regime's loyal generals and colonels. As Liam toured the dark corridors and sat down with residents on their verdant balconies, he discovered a building rife with many of the same contradictions and contrasts that have characterised Spain's transition to democracy. Today, the building is in the midst of its own transition, and we were there to capture the new wave of optimism as younger residents move in and change the dynamic.
Edificio Princesa is one of those rare, living, breathing monuments to history. While its story is unbeknown to most of those who pass by its vine-draped concrete facade each day, it is one of the city's most significant contemporary structures. Designed by the Bohemian architect Fernando Higueras for the Spanish military housing agency in the twilight years of the Francisco Franco dictatorship, the two-building complex is a modernist marvel that starkly contrasts with the fiercely traditional regime that many of its residents once swore to defend. Designed as a homestead for the retiring military brass of the dictatorship and beyond, this towering concrete complex is now being disrupted by the inevitable march of change.
We were just in love with the apartment when we saw it.
Iván Lequerica, his wife Alejandra, and two young sons are the faces of this change. As young cosmopolitan professionals, they represent the growing wave of civilians replacing the elderly generals and colonels.
So this is a very well-known building in Madrid. So most of the people know it, and I love it since the beginning.
And so much so that your parents have moved in here as well, but not in the same apartment.
Not in the same apartment, that's a good point. So my wife would love it, but no. We didn't convince them to move it here. So they came here last year. They bought an apartment close to us, and it's good.
Attracted by the architectural wonder of the exterior, the new residents are renovating the building's neglected innards. Unforeseen cost overruns in the early 1970s meant that they were never fully realised, according to Higueras' vision.
The distribution of the house, the light, I think Higueras, he was an excellent architect, and he looked forward to the people that lived inside, which is really important for an architect, and he succeeded. I heard from one of the persons that is a resident in this building for a long time that they wanted to have a swimming pool, and they did not agree at the time. But I think that it could be a good moment now with the young families to say, why not having a swimming pool in the center of Madrid?
The elusive swimming pool is perhaps the best symbol of the generational clash that often rears its head between neighbours old and new. Not long ago, regular residence meetings were stymied by the stubborn and often petty disputes between iron-willed generals. Any proposal for change, such as a swimming pool for the central garden, was promptly torpedoed.
Feliz cumpleaños, feliz.
The garden was once secured by a formidable padlock. But thankfully, today, the space is playing host to a raucous children's birthday party. As I tour the stairwells, chatting to the initially suspicious security guards, white-haired widows, and the still rigid retirees of the Spanish military, many whisper a community secret. You know Tejero lives here, right? Tejero is the infamous lieutenant colonel that led a failed military coup in the Spanish Parliament in 1981. After serving his time in prison, he is now a fiercely private individual, but many of his peers can still be seen coming and going. In recent years, they've been forced to get used to the gust of youthful air blowing into their building.
I was skating on the back road, that it's quiet and there is no a lot of traffic.
Resident Umberto is 21 and moved here with his family when he was just 6 years old.
They came to me and say that I couldn't skate because, well, it's the road and there are cars, and it's something that you realize when you are skating on the street. Obviously, old people don't like young people in the way that they make or they are noisier. They say something, but it's better if you don't answer because they get grumpy and say bad things. And, well, that's not my problem.
It is Pablo Valdez's problem, though. As the new 39-year-old community president, he is bringing a fresh approach to governance in the hope of ironing out tensions and improving how the building is run.
The former administrator was here for 25 years. It was perhaps a little worn out and didn't do very much. The building functioned. But when I arrived, I found little transparency, and important information wasn't reaching the homeowners. There was overspending and poor control of costs. I've brought in changes such as implementing an electronic voting system to make the director's board more transparent and allow opinions to be expressed. And now any homeowner who has an issue is free to knock on the administration office door, and they'll be received without any problem.
Hola, soy Liam.
Architect Ángel Cazorla moved here 10 years ago. Today, he helps to organize visits for budding architects in an attempt to share the building's unique heritage. But as he recalls, the atmosphere wasn't always so peaceful.
The community was terrible. My first meeting with all the community, every old people were discussing and arguing, and they were not really good friends. But I think things are going to changing, but very slowly, with people that are coming later, young people and my neighbors, for example. And it's important for locals to respect that there's not only old architecture good, it's also modern architecture. Some of them are good, and we have to respect not only the 19th century architecture, but also the good architecture of the 20th century that sometimes in Madrid we forget about that.
That was Monocle's Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous bringing us that report on the Edificio Princesa, and you can read and see plenty more on that in the current May issue of Monocle. And that is all we have time for on this, my last edition of Section D. Today's show, as ever, was produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer David at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you have any comments or questions. It's been a pleasure being your host, and thanks very much for listening each week. Bye-bye.